There's no reason why in the next decade we could not together ensure that every community of a certain size that desires a VPSO also has the funding to pay for one.
Governor Parnell addresses the public safety problem in rural communities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 14th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an art exhibit is deemed too controversial for a university campus.
I think more people should be more aware, because the more we turn our backs to it and live our everyday lives and forget that we're fighting a war, then what's the point?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Governor Sean Parnell announced that he plans on revitalizing the Village Public Safety Officer Program. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
The announcement was made yesterday, Tuesday, here in Bethel. Parnell says he's willing to add 15 more VPSO positions across the state. That announcement came at the Association of Village Council Presidents annual convention.
There's no reason why in the next decade, for example, we could not together ensure that every community of a certain size that desires a VPSO also has the funding to pay for one.
VPSOs are typically the first responders in many rural communities across the state. Parnell says they play a vital role in public safety, but he says they have been chronically underfunded for years. Many villages are still without VPSOs or any kind of law enforcement presence. In those communities, people must wait for law enforcement to arrive by plane or a boat to respond to emergencies and other criminal activity. But Parnell says funding is not the only obstacle to filling law enforcement voids in rural Alaska. Last year, the state funded 15 new positions.
But here's the challenge. Right now, we're struggling to fill positions that already have funding for them.
Statewide, there are 71 VPSO positions, but only 73% of those positions are filled. Parnell says he won't create the new positions until the current ones are filled. He's also calling for an increased partnership with rural communities. He says the state can help increase training, but they'll need help with operational pieces.
For a VPSO to work effectively, we have to be able to allow them to have office space, housing, transportation, and this is where I think the communities can come in.
Village public safety officers have a high turnover rate and often complain about substandard working conditions. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
During his brief address, the governor also gave an update on the administration's plans for helping rural Alaska with their energy needs, saying the state is offering an assortment of tools for people and communities to use in improving their lives. He said it begins with the Energy Guide, a 245-page directory of options available for energy sources published by the Alaska Energy Authority. He called on the AVCP leaders to take part in developing local solutions.
Once a community chooses to pursue an energy source and submits a plan to AEA, they can move forward as it best suits the specific energy needs of their community. The Energy Guide is all about communities coming together to identify needs, determine the best way forward for yourselves, and then coming up with a plan with the state partnering along with you to make that happen.
Parnell promised the budget he will introduce in December will fully fund power cost equalization assistance, now a $37 million program with a base of $1 per kilowatt. He also made a commitment to the LIHEAP, or Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which is partially funded by the federal government. He said applications for assistance rose 38% statewide under the $23 million program. The state's Renewable Energy Fund is taking applications for more projects created by the legislature in 2007, but not funded until last year. The fund has quickly gone through two rounds of applications for more than $100 million. Utilities, municipalities, tribes, and other entities are eligible to investigate, design, or build projects to use renewable energy.
We had several hundred applications in rounds one and rounds two that were last year, and we had $125 million available. And so, of course, response was very large. And now with round three coming around, response is picking up again.
That's Butch White, the grant administrator for the Alaska Energy Authority. He says for this round, they can't actually award any money until it's appropriated by the legislature, but their intent language would make $50 million more available. The application deadline is November 10th. Some projects that got earlier renewable energy grants are already up and running.
I'm thinking of the Gustavus Hydro Project, where the last renewable energy grant from round one finished the project off. And as the owner said to us, the diesels are off in Gustavus now. Then in Kodiak, the Pillar Mountain Wind Project, Kodiak Electric Association was moving forward with that project, and they had applications to us, and we put money into it. And there's, let's see, I believe there's three towers there on Pillar Mountain now, but they have, I've been up there, and they have foundations for three more after that.
White says applicants often ask for money to study, design, and build projects, but the staff generally recommends working on only a single stage at a time.
Especially in the hydro arena, there's a lot of projects like that where we've got either study money out or we're moving partway into the funding part of the design.
The state has a goal of generating 50% of its electrical power from renewable energy sources by 2025. It is already halfway there. An art exhibit at Anchorage's Alaska Pacific University has stirred up strong feelings on campus. APU's president, Doug North, says the exhibit must come down, but others say removing it is censorship. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The exhibit shows American flags displayed and folded correctly, although some are draped over oblong shapes on the floor, suggesting coffins. Viewers are asked to contribute their written thoughts on a comment board that stretches along one wall of the ConocoPhillips Gallery on campus. The heading on the comment board asks the question, why are Americans still killing and dying in the Middle East?
Yeah, I wrote All You Need Is Love.
That's Kelly Dearborn, a student at APU. She's playing the songs of the 60s on her guitar.
Every time I pass it to go to guitar lessons, it kind of actually makes me sad. I don't think we should still be fighting in the Middle East.
But APU President Doug North said in a letter posted on the comment board, quote, I think it is more a facile piece of guerrilla theater than art, although I have only seen a photograph of it, unquote. The exhibit was not reviewed by university staff before it was hung, according to North, and he wants it taken down. Jana Atkins, who is curator of exhibits at APU, when reached by phone, would not comment on either why the exhibit was not reviewed or why it was being removed. Atkins says it will come down tomorrow. The work's creator, Mariano Gonzalez, is not an APU student. Gonzalez is an associate professor of art at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and has a long resume of work to his credit. Gonzalez was not available for comment today. Meanwhile, students at APU ponder the work. Some of them were only 9 or 10 years old when the U.S. went to war in the Middle East. Guitar player Kelly says she didn't know the work was being taken down. But that may be a good thing, she says.
I don't think that it's in a good enough area for everyone to see. I think more people should be more aware, because the more we turn our backs to it and live our everyday lives and forget that we're fighting a war, then what's the point?
Kelly says she has friends fighting in the Middle East. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, more delays for fishermen waiting on Exxon Valdez settlement interest payments.
There's nothing certain about any of this in terms of the timing issue. All we have is our best guess right now, so don't go to the bank yet.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Litsite Alaska. You can discover Litsite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Litsite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
The State Senate Finance Committee is holding a rare meeting in Fairbanks today. Committee member Fairbanks Senator Joe Thomas says the session is focused on the University of Alaska budget.
How it's created, what it goes for, how diverse it actually is, which I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of people haven't been here, and some don't live in the university towns. They may have a small campus in their area, that kind of thing. So we're hoping that they get a little better understanding of the importance of the research and the many things that the university does, not only for the interior, but in the entire state.
Thomas says another goal of the one-day session is to quell fighting between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and other towns with university presence over funding of individual programs and infrastructure. He says funding of projects like a new life sciences facility at UAF has been hurt by regionalism. He says the university needs to do a better job of communicating the system-wide benefits of individual campus facilities.
Those chancellors and other folks within the administration in the individual campuses to step up and say, yeah, this is a good idea that we're doing that there. It's going to rub off on us. We're going to be handling some of the research through here. We're going to have people coming through Anchorage. It will help the community and the economy here, and a lot of people will be out in rural areas.
Thomas says he hopes the Finance Committee will hear from the public on the university as well. Lifelong Nome resident and longtime Democrat lawmaker Richard Foster has died. From KNOM in Nome, Paul Korchin has the story.
Foster held a firm grip on Alaska's House District 39 seat for two decades, first winning election to the legislature in 1988. Legislative aide Larry LeBole says Foster's death came as a blow.
He had been moved to a different care center in the Puyallup area because he was doing very well. I got word that he had had a heart attack during dialysis.
Foster suffered kidney failure a few years ago, and he had long needed a transplant. But LeBole says other health complications interfered with that.
He had to have dialysis 3 days a week, and the attack occurred during dialysis. Well, you know, he'd had that infection. They would have done the transplant earlier, but he had the staph blood infection again, and so that pretty much took the prospect of a transplant off of the screen.
Foster also suffered a stroke in early 2008, further taxing his health. Though a Democrat, Foster aligned himself with House Republicans, ascending to the position of majority whip. Although that move was criticized by some, Foster defended it by working across the political aisle and getting tens of millions of dollars for capital improvements projects across his district. Foster held a secure seat on the powerful House Finance Committee. Foster was a proud U.S. Army veteran, serving two tours of duty in Vietnam and receiving a Bronze Star. He was an avid gun collector and even ran afoul of federal authorities for his weapons. A Nome jury quickly acquitted him. Foster received a bachelor's degree at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1968 and had graduated from Nome Belts 4 years earlier. He was a former board member of the Bering Straits and Sitnasauk Native Corporations. Foster was known and beloved, or at least tolerated, for his corny jokes, as well as his faithful observance of other lawmakers' birthdays when the legislature was in session. LeBole says funeral and memorial arrangements are still pending. Richard Foster, son of Nome and public servant of Western Alaska, dead at the age of 63. I'm Paul Korchin.
Longtime ANIAC Fire Chief Pete Brown died of cancer yesterday. Brown was 64. His death came just 3 days after residents in the Middle and Upper Kuskokwim region held a celebration in his honor at the ANIAC High School. Brown is credited with saving countless lives, not only from medical emergencies, but also from suicide and depression. He gained national recognition for his work with teenagers when he started the ANIAC Dragon Slayers. Funeral services will be held tomorrow at 2 p.m. at ANIAC Point. The distribution of $466 million in Exxon Valdez oil spill interest payments has been delayed. Fishermen and other plaintiffs have been waiting 6 weeks for Judge H. Russell Holland to sign the order authorizing the payments. Frank Mullen, a Homer fisherman and financial advisor, said he discovered Tuesday that Holland has an issue with the stipulation in the order having to do with assignments from processors and has asked for clarification. He said plaintiffs' attorneys are expected to file a clarification soon, and after that, Holland will be able to sign the order of distribution for the interest payments.
It's in Judge Holland's courtroom, and he, as the administrator, can
ask questions, or there could be further delays. Things happen, things pop up, different motions are filed, and there's nothing certain about any of this in terms of the timing issue. All we have is our best guess right now, so don't go to the bank yet.
Mullen said the best case scenario is a distribution about 20 days after the order is signed.
Possibly late November rather than early November, and hey, the way this thing has gone on for 20 years, and those of us who've been watching this thing unfold, it wouldn't surprise any of us if there was, probably safe to say you tack on a couple of weeks at least to the best case scenario. So there you go. Could be December.
As a financial planner, Mullen said he would much rather the check be sent to him after the new year.
Well, if fishermen receive a check from the Exxon settlement on December 25th or late December, you know, taxes will be due on that amount on April 15th of 2010. Just strategically, I would rather see a payout come in January of 2010. Then it would give me or give anybody who received the check then a full cycle, a full year's calendar to strategically do what they can to mitigate taxation and to make some plans.
He also had some generic advice for recipients.
Pay off your debt. If you've got debt, get out of debt. Pay off your credit cards. That's clearly a good place to start. Paying off a mortgage is a very subjective thing because you have mortgage interest deduction that has value to you. So if you have a mortgage with a low interest rate, it might be better for you to put money in your long-term retirement plan. But, you know, all of those things are subject to lots of variables, you know, and analysis. So it varies on a person-by-person basis.
Mullen said those whose names are on the list to be paid interest in this round of distributions will likely be similar to those on the clean claims list, who were paid from the punitive damages award in December 2008. A fishing vessel sank near Sand Point early this morning. Willow resident Free Rudoff was piloting the vessel when it ran into trouble. From member station KSDP in Sand Point, Kels Hetherington has the story.
The 42-foot fishing vessel Sea Dancer ran aground this morning before dawn in shallow waters off Unga Island within sight of Sand Point. Sea Dancer then began taking on water, Sand Point Harbor Master Richard Kachutin explains.
I didn't go aboard, but as far as I could see, it looked like it was completely flooded. It was really low in the water. It couldn't go down anymore. Well, it's on the bottom. It couldn't go down anymore. The tide is coming in, so it's going to eventually go down further.
Kachutin got a call at 5:30 this morning that Sea Dancer was in trouble. The ship's captain and two crew members waited for the Coast Guard to arrive after letting the Coast Guard know they could hang on until near dawn.
They were at the helicopter here by 6:30, 6:45 or so is when they came on scene.
No one was injured. Sea Dancer sank 59 hours after leaving Homer. The vessel has now been pulled off the bottom and now rests in the Sand Point Boat Harbor. It remains unclear if the vessel can or will be salvaged. Kels Hetherington in Sand Point.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
Republicans in the U.S. Senate are decrying the health care bill passed by the Finance Committee yesterday. Only one Republican, Maine's Olympia Snow, crossed party lines to vote for it. Now leading Democrats in the Senate will meld the Finance Committee version with one passed over the summer by the Health Committee. Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski sits on the health panel and voted against that bill. She's not much happier with the latest finance version. Murkowski spoke today as a member of the Republican leadership team after her party's weekly Senate luncheon. She says a recent report by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office shows the Finance Committee bill won't add to the federal deficit is raising questions in Alaska.
The headlines suggested that this is all good news. Well, the folks back home were asking me, well, what does it really mean? What does it mean to be deficit neutral? But more importantly, what does it mean to me and my family? What is this going to do? What is this health care bill going to do to my insurance that I have? And when I can't come back to them and tell them with any degree of certainty that, no, this is not going to increase your premiums, they won't want to know, well, how much and why?
Republicans say the health care legislation will end up costing the government hundreds of billions of dollars in the years not covered by the budget report, but many Democrats disagree. The Finance Committee bill would expand insurance coverage to 29 million people who won't otherwise have it. Nearly all Americans would be required to have a policy, but low- and moderate-income families would get subsidies to buy them. The plan would be paid for by fees on insurance companies, drug makers, and the makers of medical devices. There would also be taxes on so-called high-end Cadillac plans. Murkowski says she fears that will come out of Americans' pockets.
And if the president has said we're not going to be increasing taxes on the middle class, on those of lesser means, then how can this be that, in fact, my taxes will be increased?
There's another option on the table. The U.S. House Committee's versions of health care legislation would be paid for by taxing the wealthiest Americans. Murkowski has said she does want to see a health care bill, but says Democrats in Congress are moving too fast crafting legislation. She says she's heard from Alaskans who do see good elements in the effort. Murkowski says they tell her they want to see some insurance industry practices stopped, such as denying coverage of pre-existing conditions. The Senate Finance Committee bill does not include a public option. Rather, it would create nonprofit member-owned cooperatives that would compete with insurance companies. Even though the Finance Committee's bill is being hailed as moving Congress further along the path to health care reform than it has been in decades, there's still much work ahead. The bills in the Senate and House have to be merged in their respective houses, then passed by the full bodies, and then merged with each other. The president says he hopes to sign a bill into law by the end of this year. Icy Straits Lumber is one of the few Alaska mills with no shortage of wood. The Huna Company has plenty of logs on hand and the rights to cut more when it's needed. But that doesn't mean life is easy for its owners or workers. The nationwide economic downturn has slowed sales of lumber, as well as the company's prepackaged cabin kits. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld visited Icy Straits about 40 miles west of Juneau to find out how it's been coping.
Wes Tyler thinks about more than round logs when he revs up his chainsaw in the forest.
I guess every tree, when I look at a tree to and a timber sale to cut it down, I'm looking at it and saying, well, let's see, I can make this out of it and that out of it and this out of it, you know, pretty well right to the, down to nothing.
So standing in his log yard outside Huna, surrounded by stacks of spruce, hemlock, and cedar, he's more interested in showing me one of his cabins. There's a small porch on the 14 by 20 foot structure. Inside, there's a living room kitchen combo with a bathroom off to the side and a stand up loft above.
You can put a full scale bed up there, and it's got a lot of room. It's quite a bit of room up there. And we make them all different sizes and shapes and heights and widths. One man's cabin is another man's home.
This cabin is fully assembled on a wheeled steel frame so it can be hauled to a plot of land in Huna. Tyler and his wife Susan have been part of Southeast Alaska's logging industry for four decades. They worked for the Huna Mill's previous owner, Whitestone Logging, and they took over 6 years ago when that company gave up on the Tongass and moved to Kodiak. The new Icy Straits Lumber sold some wood in Southeast and developed the cabin kits, prefabricated packages of ready-to-assemble finished lumber. But much of their business was selling larger dimension green timber down south. Then the economy crashed.
It's just related to the pure volume of material that you're putting through. You know, an operation this size really needs a certain economy of scale or volume to support it. And the volume has been cut way back.
So they tried developing different products. The cabin kits expanded into house kits and were customized to the buyer's plans. They added a gazebo kit to their lineup, and they got into the real estate market, placing their structures around Huna, some as rentals and others for sale.
What we're doing here is we're trying to get to where we can, instead of shipping those products down south, we're holding that wood here and taking it to the next level. It's being made into a finished product, and that's key to what we're trying to do here and our survival.
They even tapped into some federal stimulus funds, building a Forest Service cabin out of their finished yellow cedar. To show off their product, the Tylers are assembling the structure in a public spot near Hoonah's ferry terminal. It will be barged to its new home at 8 Fathom Bight to the southwest near the head of Port Frederick. Tim Hazelwood works for the Hoonah Ranger District.
This was a perfect example of putting people to work and accomplishing national objectives like recreation, outdoor recreation.
So do you like the idea of being able to use local wood in this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no better wood in the world than what he produces out there, so you bet.
The Tylers have also ventured into the art and souvenir market. They operate the Alaska Wood Creation Shop at Hoonah's Icy Strait Point. That's an old cannery rebuilt as a summertime cruise ship attraction.
Hoonah's Icy Tribal Combination Tour.
Susan Tyler, who runs the shop, says she couldn't throw away the mill scraps and ends, so she started working with locals to carve and paint totemic art, Christmas ornaments, wall sculptures, and other items. Icy Straits Lumber's value-added approach has won friends in some very different circles. Environmentalists, including the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, supported a nearby timber sale to provide a steady supply of wood. And the logging industry, including the Alaska Forest Association, praises the company for promoting new ways to sell Southeast timber. But Association Executive Director Owen Graham of Ketchikan says it's hampered by its location.
Right now, it costs them a tremendous amount of money to move the product, the finished lumber, out of Hoonah because they have to charter a barge. There's just not enough economic activity going on around there.
The Tylers are considering opening a retail outlet in Juneau, about 40 miles, and a short barge trip to the east. That could expose their products to a larger customer base. They're also hoping the economic recovery will reach their corner of Alaska soon. But with fuel prices driving freight and power costs up, Wes Tyler says this could be a tough winter. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Hoonah.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Paul Korchin in Nome, Kels Hetherington in Sandpoint, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alaska Engineering Fund, whose members include USKH Incorporated, creating sustainable solutions to support the quality of life for communities. Information online at uskh.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.